This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Well, bringing you all the up-to-date information on sexual health and well-being. Brought to you by the Victorian AIDS Council on Joy 94.9. Joy.
This is Well on Joy 94.9, brought to you every Monday evening at 8 p.m, presented by the Victorian AIDS Council. Every week we tackle all things related to sex, sexual health, and the overall health and well-being of our LGBTI communities. I'm Jack, and we have a jam-packed studio tonight. I'm joined by my lovely colleagues, John and Alex. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hello.
Good evening.
How
Jack?
Are we?
Very well.
We're awake. That's good.
And we're just going to do a recap on some issues that have come up over the past year.
Well, Jack, I just feel like I need to perhaps jump in right here and tell our dear listeners
Okay. Exactly
what we're going to do. But in fact, one of the things we should mention, this is our final show for a while.
Yeah, just for a while, not forever.
Yes,
not forever. We're just going to be taking a break and back on the airwaves later in 2017. It's a bit exciting for us because we're going to be working on a new format, perhaps looking at retooling what we do.
Retooling.
Don't be dirty.
Trying not to be, but it's hard with the two of you.
Oh, it's terrible.
So with this in mind, we thought we might chat about some topics that are certainly on our radar. So, John,
yes,
do tell our lovely listeners what we might have in store for them tonight.
So we've got quite a few things on. Just looking forward about what might be happening over the few months that we're not on the air. We have women's health, lesbian, bisexual and queer women's health to be specific. We're also going to look at the news about the new Pride Centre site down in St Kilda, so talk about that a bit. And actually a bit about drug law reforms, which sounds really dull but is actually incredibly exciting, some of the stuff that's going to be happening. And hopefully we'll get some more news there. But yeah, we love it when our listeners get involved in the conversation, as you all well know, especially this being our last show for a little while, so we'd love to hear from you. You at home can get in touch with us or send questions into the studio. Alex, tell them how they can do that.
Well, if you want to get in on the conversation out there, we want to hear from you, of course. So please send an SMS on 0427-JOY949, or you can email us at onair@joy.org.au. Joy.
This is Well on Joy 94.9. Now, there's been a great deal of attention paid to drug and alcohol issues lately, particularly with renewed calls for the establishment of a safe injecting facility in North Richmond. This is only one of the many initiatives that will help those who experience problems with drugs and alcohol use. And our policy analyst, John Manwaring,
hello,
has been doing a lot of work on these very issues lately. So, John, can you tell us a bit more about the proposed safe injecting facility?
Yeah, so this isn't the first time they've called for it, because as we know, there have been a lot of drug use issues in kind of hot spots around the city. So the renewed call is from the sex party, from Fiona Patton, and it's basically to conduct a pilot, a study facility in North Richmond, because this is a place that's become somewhat infamous over the past few months. Several deaths there, overdose deaths, problems with people not accessing syringes, so they're reusing syringes, they're discarding them inappropriately, so that's, you know, opening other hazards up, and just causing a lot of kind of damage to the community around there and community confidence. So the idea is that even though we know these things work, we have to study it in the local context, and that there is a clinic that would be established there, and people who need to use drugs, use substances, could go in. There are nurses on hand at all times. They're not provided with drugs there. They'd have to bring their own drugs with them. But you basically have somebody there to make sure that you don't overdose, that if you have any issues, that your health isn't in jeopardy, that you're using a new clean needle so you're not at risk of, you know, hepatitis or HIV or all these things. So it's quite a comprehensive and forward-thinking thing.
So this would just be a pilot study for sake of a better word. So
yeah, for now anyway.
For now. So what are the odds of do you know what the numbers could be in the parliament to get a pilot off the ground?
It's tricky to say because, the crossbench is a little weird. We have so many different parties, but the Greens are all in favor of it. And oddly, the Liberal Party, there are a lot of people who individually support it. So people oh, I shouldn't name names because I'm not 100% certain, but there are people in the party who are supportive.
So some progressives within the Liberal Party would even be open to it.
Yeah, even people who you wouldn't necessarily consider progressive. They're just, I suppose, pragmatic is the right word to say. But for some reason, the Andrews government has decided to oppose it. So they haven't said that they'll stop the legislation. Mm-hmm. They just say, on principle, we don't support this.
And yet the evidence is there. There's been other, if not trials, there's been other occasions in other jurisdictions where it has worked.
I mean, we have the safe injecting facility in King's Cross in Sydney that was meant to be a pilot. It's now been there for, I think, 16 years. Mm-hmm. It's something that is done widely throughout Europe. I think Switzerland piloted it first in the earlier mid-80s, and it's so successful there that nearly every country in Europe has some form of these. And they'll also call them drug consumption rooms because they recognize that harm can come from not just injecting drug use, but just drug use generally. Yeah. So it's to make sure that people are using these things safely without making any sort of moral judgments on drugs and drug use, because we know from long years that doesn't actually help anybody with their use.
This is always about harm reduction, harm minimization, and that's the platform that's been pushed for a long time. But this is really something that's been tried and truly demonstrated in many parts of the world. So it's a logical step. And I know I'm being logical because there's a lot of emotion in this as well, obviously.
Well, but it's actually, you saying that, you raise a really valid point that we need to be logical about it, because I think when we inject so much emotion into the issue, we're kind of blinded to what it is. And there are a lot of issues like that. You know, abortion is one of them. The death penalty, maybe not here so much as in the U.S., but people get, I think it allows them to cloud their judgment and ignore the evidence, where we have so much evidence that says, actually, these, you know, the laws that penalize these sort of stuff actually cause more harm than good.
Certainly.
And
we're talking about saving lives here. Absolutely. In many cases. I mean, that is a pivotal element to this kind of conversation, isn't it?
And that's what it boils down to. It's
Another aspect of drug law reform is drug decriminalization. Now, what are we talking about here, John? What are the drugs that we are thinking may be decriminalized, or some people are proposing?
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a... We need to unpack the issue quite carefully, because I think it's such a strange concept that it's easy to misunderstand. I know it's taken me a while to understand it. So we're not talking about legalizing drugs to the point that you can walk into your local Coles and Woolworths and, you know, buy a gram of heroin or something and go use it. It's the idea that, all right, criminalizing drug use, personal drug use, mind you, not, you know, I'm a distributor or a dealer, but... just somebody who uses from time to time, addiction, whatever, that part doesn't matter. Say, I'm using it for personal use. Criminalizing these people and throwing them into jail actually doesn't help the problem. It makes it worse. It exacerbates addiction and dependence problems. It basically introduces them into the criminal justice system and worsens all those kind of socioeconomic factors that contribute to drug use and problematic drug use. So decriminalization is saying, all right, instead of saying you go to jail if you get caught with drugs, we just won't bother. If anything, there will maybe be a fine. But it's more about treating it as a public health issue than a criminal law issue, and saying, let's take care of this. So if your use is problematic and you are struggling, that you are getting the help that you need. And again, it's putting aside those moral judgments. And there are plenty of people who have moral judgments about drugs but can still support those sorts of things. Like Jeff Kennett is one, I think.
That's right. That's a significant... statement.
Well, he's, back in government, they had the Pennington, when he was in government, that is, they had the Pennington Review or something like that.
Yep.
And that's what it says, decriminalization. This is something we need to do. And I think they even went to an election on the issue, and or Labour went to an election on the issue, won the election, and then there was such a fuss about it that they kind of dropped it by the wayside.
Now, I heard Jeff Kennett interviewed not that long ago, just in the last couple of weeks, and he was quite profound in his support for reform in this area, and you know, very practical, sensible thing coming from a conservative politician.
Yeah, it's kind of remarkable to see the changes that have come over him. I wasn't here when he was in government, but to see, wow, he's really gone quite a distance.
Yes, and that's not an uncommon thing. When people leave office, they see things through a different prism, through a reality. There's a reality check, I think.
Yeah, they're no longer beholden to those sorts of, I guess, pressures and demands of having to be accountable to voters. Hey.
That's right. You're out loud and proud and listening to Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9, and we're talking to John Manwaring about drug law reform. Now, John, you're talking previously about drug decriminalization, and in safe injecting room. Sniffer dogs. What can you tell me about sniffer dogs? There's a move afoot that they could or should be banned from various events.
Well, yeah, so there's this issue that... And it's not just events. That's where it's really kind of localized. You need to get a high concentration of people who are vulnerable to this. But you have people being bullied, harassed with these sniffer dogs and made to be quite scared of criminal penalties. And supposedly this dissuades people from drug use, but we know it doesn't. And what often happens in these situations, maybe not often, but often enough, is people will be, you know, going into a club, they'll be in public, there will be a sniffer dog, they're worried about getting caught. So in order to not have any evidence on them, we'll consume all of their drugs all at once, end up overdosing, end up in hospital, and in a few cases this results in death. But this is on the back of studies that have been done in New South Wales about sniffer dogs that show that they're accurate about 20% of the time.
That's not a very good ratio.
20% of the time. Mm. Yeah, and so it's like, how can we justify, like even if they were effective, they're 100% effective, fair enough. And if it's your policy to say, we don't want anybody using drugs, full stop, fair enough. But they're not accurate. So you end up striking fear in people. If there's harassment, they don't trust the police, they don't trust the government. It creates this whole problem about how people engage with, not politics so much, but with the legal system and what that means. And if it's going to have authority, that needs to change.
Sure.
So yeah, that's something that we're, many people have called on the government to say, all right, we just need to stop doing this. We stop using them. There hasn't so far been no word from the government about whether that's going to stop, or from the police, that is, but... Yeah.
Now, John, we've just got a message in. North, it says, North Richmond Community... I'll take my glasses off because they're multifocal. I can't read. North Richmond Community Health don't even have a Schedule 8 methadone suboxone GP. So how will they administer an injecting room? Would you like to comment?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting... It's a really valid point because one of the best things that Australia has done, in Victoria in particular, for people who are experiencing drug dependence is this drug substitution programs. So if you are struggling with heroin use, opiate addiction, you can go to a doctor and they can prescribe you with basically... They're not the real drugs, but they kind of help you manage cravings and all that and without causing the harms that you would normally expect. So I think it's a little bit of a, that's not a false dichotomy, that's not the right expression, but this idea that's like, just because they don't have drug substitution programs at this clinic doesn't mean they can't do a safe injecting facility. But what that does highlight is the fact that this drug substitution program in the state is very spotty. People who need access to it, really desperately need access to it, aren't getting access to it because, you know, doctors are limited to so many patients that they're allowed to prescribe to before they have to do all sorts of courses and all this. But also geographically, there's no kind of uniform spread of access to this. So you might be somebody who lives in, and this is just an example, mind you. You might be a person who lives in St. Kilda, but say the nearest prescriber is up in Thomastown. Mm-hmm. So you might need it, but because there's this barrier, this impediment to actually getting access to it, you don't get access to it. And so you're cut out of this really helpful tool for managing drug dependence. And so when it comes back to the North Richmond Community Health, I think that's another thing that we've been highlighting with this drug law reform inquiry that's going on, is saying that this needs to be better. So if we're going to have needle syringe programs everywhere widely rolled out, if we're going to have a safe injecting facility, we need to make sure that there's better access to these different tools of harm reduction and treatment. So
The listener's pointed out a very good point, hasn't it? I wasn't going to say he, but the listener, thank you for writing that in because you've shed some light on something that's quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think it's something that people need to keep kind of the keep the fire going on it.
We really need some political pressure and community pressure
to let people know one tool isn't enough.
There's so much happening in this space, and it can be quite a complex space. But another area of interest is around the notion of pill testing.
Yeah. So it's similar to sniffer dogs. You get this idea that there are people who are at festivals, clubs, all these things. And we've heard lots of stories about in South Yarra at Meyer Music Bowl a few weeks back, people who are consuming bad batches of drugs.
Chapel Street.
Yeah, exactly. Some people, sometimes resulting in death, many people injured and, experiencing really poor health outcomes because of it. Oddly, you can go online, about $6. They have these little testing kits. You just scrape off a little bit of the drug, plop it in there. It gets out this reading that's basically this color-coded chart that tells you more or less what's in there. So it can't give you like the full lab results saying, oh, this is the chemical component. But you can see what's actually there. So if you bought ecstasy, you can see if there's ecstasy in there. Or you can see if there's also, say, something poisonous that could really damage you. Or you might think you're buying ecstasy, but you've actually bought methamphetamine. And so just having access to that, again, people don't want to do this because they think it's promoting drug use, but really what it's doing is keeping people safe and actually results in less drug use because people are less likely to take drugs if they know that they're bad batches. If they don't know, if they think they're fine and they take them, then they're poisoned, then they die. So we need to keep remembering this. So this is another thing we've highlighted in that inquiry.
And just quickly, John, any views on needle and syringe programs in prisons? Do they happen or... Do they don't happen?
They do not happen in Australia. The ACT tried to do one a few years back. And so we're all familiar with NSPs. This is something that made...
They're effective.
Yeah.
Have been for 20 years.
HIV epidemic is so, relative to other countries, so low because of this, like in large part.
Yes.
And so we're saying, why don't we extend that to prisoners? Because there is a lot of concern about the safety of the guards. The thing is, we are constantly referring to Europe in this, these things are everywhere in Europe. Nearly every prison in Spain has these. And there's maybe been a single incident of a guard being attacked or, you know, somehow damaged by a needle. Now, in prisons...
Because that's the counter-argument that would come from law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fair. Like, it's perfectly fair that they should be concerned about their safety. But we look at the number of times that people are basically have needle stick injuries when they're doing, you know, inspections of cells. Yeah. And these are needles that have been smuggled in. They are not high quality. They have been used and used and used time and time again. And now the prison staff is exposed to that. Whereas when they're NSPs in the prison, they basically exchange the needle. So they don't keep it. They still get to do what they need to do, and that's it. So it's, again, these kind of common sense, rational, logical things.
And that's the thing. It's logical. Yeah. And the fact is that you said... used over and over and over again is a critical issue here around spreading of bloodborne viruses. Yep. Absolutely.
John, look, thanks for the little insight. We're just doing a bit of an overview on drug law reform. So that's great, John. Thank you. You're on Well, 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 and we're talking next about women's health. Lots more coming up too. So don't forget, you can join us in the conversation. Send an SMS to 0427JOY949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au. This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
We rarely hear enough about women's health issues in the LGBTI space, and we know there's a lot going on in that space. So one of those initiatives is the LBQ, or Lesbian, Bisexual and Queer Women's Health Conference. So,
indeed.
Gentlemen, what is the LBQ Women's Conference?
It's coming up in July. This year will be the third Women's Health Conference.
Yes, that's
right. It was started 2 years ago in Melbourne, and it grew last year, significantly grew last year.
Yeah,
and there's a keynote speaker from overseas, from London.
Okay. And who's that?
I can't recall her name, John. That's terrible. Sorry, terrible. But this year, because we've been palling up with other players in the space, and ACON is one of those partners. And next year it is in Sydney, not in Melbourne.
Yeah. So we're going to start rotating it around the country because it was a VAC and, I know there was another, it might have been Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria, but we all partnered together the first year and thought it'll be nice, some workshops, some talks, and it was quite small. Then obviously there's such a demand for more information, more work, more research in lesbian, bi, and queer women's health because people often don't consider that they have needs that are unique to that community, that are different from heterosexual women or just the general population, or even the rest of the acronym spectrum.
That's right. The conference, I know, will explore best practice and available research in working with the LBQW in mental health areas, sexual health, alcohol and other drug use, which we were tackling before, and broader health, women's health issues, and the contributing social factors that impact upon women's health. I know for a fact that you'd know this, Alex, down at the PLC, women clients are like the David Williams Fund are sometimes disproportionately represented as a percentage of the epidemic, of HIV epidemic, because there's other social factors. There's financial areas.
Absolutely, and that really just reflects itself in a lot of areas, such as utilisation of services in terms of issues around family and so forth. So it's a complex arena, but you're absolutely right. So we do see women use different services or access different services at a disproportionate rate to the rest of the community. So, and I guess there's a lot of reasons for that if we really looked at unpacking some of those issues. I guess issues around discrimination would come to mind, gentlemen?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually, so there's very, this is the problem. There's very little research about the specific needs. What we have are the private life studies that come out of the arches at La Trobe, the research in, another very long acronym, goodness. But what we do know from that is that, like you said, they're very unique concerns. They are more likely, LBQ women are more likely to experience mental health issues than in the general population. But even when you compare them to other people in the gay community, so gay, bisexual, and trans men, significantly higher rates of mental health issues. Substance use, they have wildly higher rates of smoking, for example, which is, it's interesting. We know it's there, we just don't know why, whether it's cultural, whether it's, well, we just don't know. And that's hopefully what this conference will help do, is highlight some of those disparities in health outcomes and some of the information that we have yet to do, and target areas for research.
And with less visibility, that feeds into less research and therefore less funding that goes into health promotion and health services aimed at LBQ women. So it's a vicious cycle, a vicious circle, if you like.
Joy 94.9.
You're listening to Well, 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 and we've been talking about the LBQ Women's Conference that's coming up. Gentlemen, one of the areas that we perhaps haven't talked a little bit about in terms of this is around issues of culturally and linguistically diverse groups. I've always found it hard to say that. And my groups, refugee groups, very much connected to that. And that has a specific area of concern, if you like, around women.
Well, there's a lot of disadvantage in those groups already, isn't there?
Absolutely. I guess you're starting off from a very difficult base. And I guess certainly from my experience, when we talk about women living with HIV, again, I know that's part of that community. In terms of access to services, coming from a different background can be an incredibly insurmountable barrier for many women. It's about how do we address those sorts of really fundamental issues for people.
And build trust with services, because if you're coming from a cold background and you've had all sorts of experiences, you may mistrust some sort of institutionalized services.
And certainly when the communities are small and, you know, very, very close, and concern around, disclosure and your own privacy becomes paramount. And how do you ensure that occurs for people as well?
And often women are the sole supporter if they've got children. There's a lot of issues around domestic violence. There's all sorts of things. There's layers and layers of complexity when it comes to women's health and LBQ women's health particularly.
Absolutely.
Well, one of the big things we've seen has been just the ability and the willingness to engage at all, because they have so many concerns like that. Various concerns and in different degrees, but something as simple as calling a doctor or going to a doctor, if you're culturally and linguistically diverse, you don't know if that person's going to speak your language, if they're going to understand your cultural background and cultural heritage. I mean, we hear stories with people from Aboriginal backgrounds about this all the time, about the dynamic and the communication that has to occur and how they communicate, because abiding by those traditions, some people can or cannot deliver advice to certain people, which complicates it. And how are health services, how are doctors, how are places like VAC going to cater to that? And how do we engage with those communities to help them understand that we want to create safe places for them?
It is about cultural sensitivity, and we talk about that a lot. Yeah. But in many ways, we have to be even more sensitive to some of the norms within different cultures in terms of women.
Well, that's right. If you're a lesbian or a trans woman, accessing health services or support services.
It's amazing to think that when Equinox has been in existence a year and a half, to think that before that it was just a smattering of a few select general practitioners in Melbourne alone who could address those health concerns, and only because they had the choice to do that. Well, really, we need to be engaging with all GPs and the training societies and the med schools to actually say, no, this is a legitimate and a needed area.
Yeah.
But again, it's making sure that they have the information as they're being taught these things, so when they actually do go into practice, they can do it correctly and serve the people well. But that's the big question, eh?
Absolutely. Yep. I guess one of the things to talk about is if people want to be involved, how can they do this? So submissions for ideas and abstracts are still open, if that's correct.
That's correct, they extended it.
Yes, that's right.
So if you've done work or research within the LBQ Women's Framework, we really do encourage you to think about making a submission. And if you want to find out more about this, please go to www.lbq.org.au.
Yes, so the conference will be taking place up in Sydney, like we said, the Teachers Federation Conference Centre in Surry Hills, the 13th and 14th of July. If you're very interested in this and you can make it up there, highly recommend it. I got to go one past year and it was incredibly educational. So, but yeah, check that website. Listen, we're talking women's health right now, but when we come back, we'll be talking a bit more about the new Pride Centre and what that means for our community. Please join in on the conversation. We've been engaging with us tonight. We love it. Send an SMS to 0427-JOY-949 or email us at onair@joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Well, Well, Well. Now, Jack, I believe we have a message or two.
We've got a couple of messages. We've got one from LaShonda of South Yarra.
LaShonda.
Saying that, well, 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 you guys are amazing. We will really miss you guys when you go on your break. You're covering some great topics and doing great work. Thank you, LaShonda.
Great name, LaShonda.
There's something else there, I think, too.
We've also have some messages. Oh, it's our listener who was talking earlier about the problem with the methadone and suboxone prescription, which is absolutely an issue, but the fact that a lot of doctors just kind of refuse to prescribe it, even though they absolutely have the right to, and sending us to some pretty good resources, which is really important. So, yeah, it's something with the drug law inquiry that's coming up, the results of which should be delivered just before the next state election. So I think we've got 18 months. But that's something that we definitely made a submission on, and I was looking at a few other organizations like Harm Reduction Victoria and some others who are a little more skilled in drug and alcohol issues have done the same thing. So hopefully, hopefully, if nothing else, we'll see some movement on that. I do know the state government did recently update the guidelines on that to try and streamline it, but that's so new that we have yet to see any product of that. So
stay tuned to the listener with those very good questions.
And stay engaged. It's great that there are people out there that are passionate about this. So thank you for your contribution.
Well, drug reform, it certainly is a very energetic topic, and we've been talking about a few different things tonight. We've been talking about the Lesbian, Bisexual and Queer Women's Health Conference, drug reform as we've just talked about. But another thing that's been spoken about over the last week, and I guess we do need to talk about this, just over a week ago now, a year ago, approximately April, I think the Andrews government put a lot of energy into the fact that we were going to have a Pride Centre. So St Kilda is going to be the home of Australia's first Pride Centre. So Fitzroy Street will be a permanent hub for members and allies of the LGBTI community. So that's
fantastic.
Fantastic news. Over a week ago, I think it was Friday a week ago, Minister for Equality Mark Foley announced the planned location, calling it a milestone. He said that the Pride Centre is long overdue, and we all agree with that. It's exciting news for the LGBTI community and yet another welcome addition to St Kilda. Our LGBTI community has a lot to be proud of. I congratulate everyone involved and we look forward to seeing the site come to life. So that is exciting news.
That's
gentlemen.
His quote, is it? That's from the Martin Foley's quote.
Oh, absolutely.
Great. Okay. I know the Fitzroy Street Traders Association were very keen for it, and the City of Port Phillip as a major council, they were vying for it, and so they were the successful ones.
Yeah.
And we must remember too that the old Positive Living Centre was in Ackland Street, and that housed our clinic, the PLC, community support. So we're going back to our roots somewhat, just around the corner.
Yeah, no, it's great. Like, I'm as a North Sider, I'm a little disappointed because it's going to take me 45 minutes on the train.
I think
it's amazing that we're going to have a community, a safe community space that, I think in the era of kind of the political discourse that's taking place right now, one of the biggest threats to us is if we don't speak up, if we don't stand out and basically demand our rights and equality. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that we're going to have this building that will be there for at least 20 years, but probably longer, to say that we are a community, we are strong, we are visible, is absolutely remarkable.
Mm. Now, I know it's a few years away because they've got the site. They need to do some destruction and reconstruction.
Yes.
And it's sort of diagonally opposite the Gatwick Hotel. That's the vicinity.
Right behind the Centre Clinic, actually.
That's right.
So it's like an L-shaped site. So we've got the Centre Clinic right there. The Pride March that happens at the end of midsummer will be right there as well.
Yep.
And this big site that's pretty accessible to most everybody.
Yeah. So when we talk about a hub, this really is. You're talking about the fact that the medical centre is there. So, and we will have a presence within this Pride Centre.
Also, there's other community groups. So who... Yes. can tell us who is going in with us.
Now, it's all very, fingers crossed. Like, we don't know definite sure, but almost certain RVAC will be located there. That's almost certain. Joy is probably one of them. Midsummer, Melbourne Queer Film Festival. But then the great thing about this is that there are so many smaller community organizations that do work all across the state that don't have homes. It is literally people operating out of their, you know, bedrooms and living rooms. They will finally have a place. So if you're familiar with Ross House down on Flinders Street, it's kind of a work share space. It's great for organizations like that. It's sounding like they might use that sort of model on the Pride Center, though again, these details are all still up in the air.
Certainly.
There's going to be some consultation, but it'll be a really great place.
And I love this word synergy, but I guess the fact is that you'll have a lot of these small groups, that there'll be a synergy between them in terms of delivery of service, in terms of doing what they want to do for the community. So this is just a real step forward. And when we're talking about money, this is a big commitment, $38 million. So it's just fantastic.
But is that what the government's putting, 38?
No, not the, that's the total cost. Yeah. The government's putting in a component of
15 million.
So it's VAC, City of Port Phillip, and the Victorian government have all contributed. That's I think, why that site won out, was because it's going to be an owned building. The Pride Center will be an organization that owns the building, so it will have some permanence there. It's going to be a much better center that will allow organizations like VAC to not have to put their money toward, you know, property, but they can actually put it towards, say, services and the long-term sustainability of the organization. So it gives a lot of security to the organization. So it's really exciting. And
so stay tuned. It'll take a couple of years to build.
Sounding like December 2019 is what I heard is the earliest, but knowing how planning and construction goes, I would be excited if it was there before 2022.
I'm just wondering how secure it all is if there is a change of government, but I'll just leave that floating in the air.
Oh, God.
Just leave that floating.
Let's be
optimistic.
Heart palpitations.
Okay. You're on Well, 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 and this is Joy 94.9.
Why Gender is a support and advocacy group for trans and gender diverse people aged 25 and under. We run regular events and work to combat transphobia. For more information on our events and services, email info@whygender.org.au or check out our website, whygender.org.au. Joy 94.9 is proud to share this community service message for Why Gender.
Joy 94.9.
Well, oh, hey. Jack, John, we get ourselves confused.
Well, we do. But this is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9. Now, John Alex, this was our last show for quite a while.
Oh, dear.
How do we feel? I'm sure our listeners out there, some may be glad to hear the end of us. Others may miss us. But anyway, but we'll be back in a few months.
I want to say 1st of August or first week of August. But that, don't quote me on that. We'll update you on that in the meantime.
How will we be filling our Monday nights for between 8 and 9?
We specifically.
No, not us, but the listeners out there. Because I know this spot will be taken by a lesbian book club.
Oh, that's right.
Brought to us by Alice and Tennille.
The lovely Tennille. Wonderful person. I've never met Alice, sadly. But that should be a nice way to fill it, and we'll go nicely with outtakes right before. Got a little artistic bent to the night.
And we're going to take the time to reorganize the show, to reconsider the way we do it, rejig and retrain some people, get some other voices on, so you may not hear all our voices.
No, but again, when we come back, hopefully what we'll be able to do is look at some issues a bit more in depth rather than being a bit scattergun as we have been at times, but hopefully be a bit more responsive to you as a community and give you some input into what we do and make sure that we're responding to what you need. So it's pretty exciting.
But we'll keep you all updated if you go to our website and our Facebook, facebook.com/vac.org.au, or just our website, vac.org.au. Alex, what will you be doing?
Well, my kitchen rules end soon, so I may not be focusing on that.
That's a relief, isn't it?
I'm not sure. A bit of reading. I'll be listening to Joy.
You can listen to Alice and Tennille.
Absolutely.
Alice is the lovely volunteer coordinator here at Joy.
Okay, wonderful.
And Tennille is the boss.
Yeah, she is. Hey.
Lovely Tennille and lovely Alice are doing their show, Lesbian Book Club. So do tune in on Monday nights for the book club, and we will be back in probably the first of August with a new show. So this is not goodbye.
Definitely not.
And it's just a little farewell while we're busy planning our new format and our return, of course. But you can always listen to our previous shows if you get really in need of listening to our voices via podcast, and they're available to listen to here at joy.org.au or via iTunes, of course, and you can go through our website as well. Thanks, as always, to our expert volunteer, David, who looks after all of our podcasts. David, he does a great job and makes us sound much, much better than we really are. For more information about any of the things we've discussed tonight, you can, of course, visit joy.org.au/wellwellwell. And the 2017 LBQWH conference will be hosted by ACON and held in Sydney over 2 days on July 13th and 14th. So don't forget the Women's Conference in Sydney, July 13 and 14. That's visit lbq.org.au for more information. This is Jack and the team signing off. Stay tuned to Joy. Sonia will be here with Broad. Look out for us in the coming months in August.
All right.
Cheers. This is Joy 94.9. Have a good break.
We'll see you soon.
Good night, everyone. Joy.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.